Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
I'm talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Hello, and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allender on the board. S&P futures down 13, NASDAQ futures down 66. We've been sliding over the last couple of days, which is a little unusual for the this time of the year. As a matter of fact, our friend Kenny Pulcheri thought we were going to be over 7,000 today in the S&P, but looks like we're going the other way, at least right now. That doesn't mean we won't. It's going to close out the year with a 17% gain. That's still pretty good, though. I mean, that's like really good. I just hope that a lot of people are taking a solid look at their portfolio and wondering if the same playbook, investment playbook for this year is going to be the same as last year. And I think you should make a determination there, especially if you have some concentration issues. And if you think you did it all yourself because the market went up, I don't know. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. But one of these days there might be some other kind of market you have to trade, and I think it's kind of coming. But I don't know. You know, I don't know when. I mean, what I'm seeing with the metals and stuff up and down all over the place is not lead me to believe with some of these stocks pretty darn expensive that this, you're going to just sit there and do nothing and make 17% next year. It would be nice if we did, but do we have Professor Kevin?
Speaking of doing nothing, yeah, you got me.
There you go. I'm just saying everybody's locked into this playbook that's been good for a while, and some things change, Kevin, after some times, but then, you know, we'll see. Might be another couple of good years out of it. Might be as we pour more money into the system. It's pretty... I've talked to a bunch of clients over the last few days kind of reviewing the year, and you know, that's kind of the deal. I mean, stuff is pretty expensive. It's had a big year. Normally, you would say kind of enough's enough on some of the stuff, especially the ones that seem incredibly overpriced. And then you look at what the government's doing to their money, and maybe you might want to, you know, that's the other side of the coin. For every buyer, there's a seller, right? Every time you think a stock is a good buy, somebody's more than willing to sell it to you, right? And he just might be the guy smarter today, although nobody thinks that way. But it's
either smarter or desperate for cash.
One or the other, yeah. I mean, there's always some reason why you're the smart one and the other guy, you know, has to sell his or has to buy it. He just might be the smart guy, you know. Also, a little concern, as I've been talking about, I don't know that much about it, but I'm sort of, it's a little odd with the deal. Now, today we've got a rally in the Bitcoin, and we've got gold and silver going the other way. And here's what's weird about the news, Kevin. Silver's had this big run up and down, and yesterday it bounced back from being the huge turnaround Sunday night. But now today the headlines are that China's going to restrict silver exports. And your buddy Elon Musk is all over that, how outrageous that is. Yet silver's down today. So, I mean, this is when you get the information and when you don't, this is really very difficult to trade. I mean, if you got the information 2 days ago, I suppose when it flew down, you were a buyer. But then all of a sudden, you know, when it's buy the rumor, sell the news in a lot of instances, and it's really very difficult to play the timing on this. And how much are they really going to restrict the exports? They're just going to talk about it? Are they going to do it? And, you know, this is all when it becomes this, you know, high end game of countries doing this stuff. You know, they're front running. I mean, you maybe can think that the, you know, Trump administration is moral and would never do such a thing, but I don't think I would say the Chinese are all that moral to you. If they're gonna restrict silver, somebody's been buying this stuff up from. I mean, every day I keep saying, who the hell's buying all this silver? Well, duh. Maybe the Chinese have been leaking this out for the last week, and some people knew. It's a great world we live in, isn't it? Happy New Year.
It's always an interesting world, isn't it?
Yeah, Happy New Year. I watched the Irish last night. Does anybody think that was basketball? What is that?
It was very similar to some of the old time Big Ten stuff that you used to watch, or maybe even some of the old time Big East, you know, where they just beat the crap out of each other. For those who don't know, Notre Dame beat Stanford out on the West Coast, 47-40.
So you have to fly from South Bend to Stanford to play a 40-minute game.
Well, they're staying out there because they play California next.
Okay, well, that makes some sense.
It's a West Coast road trip, and hey, you know what? If they come back with two wins from that, we'll call it good because the Irish are without their best player. He got hurt a few weeks ago. He should be back in a few, I think. He's still got a little time, a little recovery time. Although watching him on the sideline yesterday, he seemed to have a little bit of spring in his step. Which he hasn't had it at any of the games so far, so that's good to see, because they really don't have a ball handler. So you know they have a freshman forward who's been handling the ball, and he's their leading scorer and he does a lot of things well. He had like 8 turnovers last night, so that wasn't good. But it was pretty ugly basketball. But I just sit there and say, you know, walk out of there with a win at this point of the season, getting started into the conference. Just get the W and see what happens later on. But
well, I watched them. I watched the Bulls, and there's still some teams in the NBA to play somewhat basketball. But everybody else, you know, there's 4 guys hanging in the 3-point area. A guy will dash through the middle and maybe kick it back out. I was watching some game the other night. The team was 5 for 25 from 3. I mean, if I'm the coach, I go, the next one of you idiots who takes the 3-point shot is walking home. I mean, how do you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result?
No, it's interesting. Back in the days when I had the side hustle covering Notre Dame basketball, there was one time because I was writing an article about this. What do you do when you've missed a bunch of shots? It's what's the shooter's mentality? And almost everyone said, look, coach says, you know, if you're open, if it's a good shot and you got it in the flow of the offense, take it. I don't want you to hesitate, even if you've missed a bunch. But, you know, that was almost everyone. I only had one guy, Jaren Grant, said, and it was clear in the statistics. I already knew what he did. I just wanted to see if he would admit it. He said he heat checks, and you know, if he makes the first couple, he's going to keep taking them. But if he misses his first couple, he just dials it back in. He says, then it's all attack the basket. He is the only basketball player over the years who ever copped to that.
Every time this
happens, so Grant was a very streaky shooter, but he was a smart guy.
Oh, no, it's a good guy. Good guy.
Yeah, and so you know, he was smart enough to say, if I'm making, keep taking them. But if I'm not making them, then you know, back off.
Well, it becomes this world of the wrong people being given statistics when they should be banned from them. How's that for a statement for the new year? If I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that if you were to take somebody who really knows how to shoot, which I, of course, in my era, nobody would have that kind of range because why would you? There was no 3-point line. But I have no doubt that if you get somebody who really knows how to shoot and you shot him, made him shoot from 21 feet or whatever the line is, and made him shoot from 18 feet, that his percentages wouldn't be that much different to where one was 2 points and the other 3 points. I doubt if he'd be 50% higher on his percentage from 18 than he was from 21. So the statistics are always going to tell you the three-point shot is a better statistical move. However, that is so friggin' ignorant, I can't go there, because that's not what you're doing. And when you decide that you're not even going to work for the other shot, and no matter what, the last 2 seconds, who's ever got it behind 3-point range, heaves it up. That's not how the statistics are determined, I don't think. Where it's your fallback shot is the 3, and no matter who takes it, no matter if I went out and tried to take it, now it's still a better shot. No, it's not. No, it's not. And what you lose the entire working for the quote easy shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more than just the one line statistic. It's way more than that. It's like saying, oh, you should always go on 4th and 2. Not if you and I are playing center and guard, and when we're going against Lawrence Taylor. I mean, there's way more to this. Statistics are just what they are. They're just a tool. It's like trading. You know, oh man, we're up 62% of the time on Christmas Eve. Gee, I'll buy on Christmas Eve. Wait a minute, a war just started, you idiot. I mean, there's way more to this stuff, right?
Yeah, you just had me thinking, though. So two things. One is, when you and I go up against Lawrence Taylor, it's important to keep in mind that LT is, how old is he? He is 66 years old, so...
I still bet on him.
We're both in our 70s, so it would still be an interesting matchup, though, so if we were going up against Lawrence Taylor today.
I'll make you a deal. I'll hit him low and just fall on the ground in front of him, you hit him high.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. he'll step on me, but I don't know.
But to last night's game, the Irish only took 16 three-point shots because they weren't making them. Their two best shooters were 0-for for the game, and they're both very good three-point shooters, but boy, for some reason they just couldn't hit a damn thing last night. In fact, Braden Shrewsbury had no points and missed all his shots, both, you know, three-point and two-point, and then right at the end of the game, he went to the free throw line for 1-1. He's an 80%+ free throw shooter, and he missed that too. So
wow.
Whatever was going on with him was, and you know, get your eyes examined or whatever you have to do, because he had a really bad, he had a bad shooting night. But he's their best defender by far, though. So he was still on the court for 30 of the 40 minutes because he is a really good defender.
What is the? There's a question I can dump on you, but what is the? It's New Year's. Everybody's on break, I assume, but God, there's nobody in the stands.
Yeah, students are gone home.
Now, what can you, when you see the whole sideline that's kind of empty, in most schools, is that students or is that paying customers?
Very few schools put their students on the side. Duke does. You know, they have that little Cameron Crazy thing working on. They have a student section carved out that's, you know, kind of takes one sideline and then stretches around the corner there. But most schools are Notre Dame is this way, North Carolina, et cetera. You know, all these students, they pretty much put them in the end at one end of the court.
What is the, you and I, when we try and figure out what the live gate is for football, we're always trying to figure out how many of the students go. And at Notre Dame, I won't say it's free, but the football ticket is included with your tuition, so everybody gets one. So I'm going to say 99%. The only time you ever locked your door was when there was a football game, and they would have a guard in every dorm because that's the only time anybody ever wanted to rob anything would be during a game because nobody was there. But for a long time, I don't think Indiana had a big student thing there. I mean, Ohio State, the place holds 102 or something, but there's 85,000 students there. Now, I don't think 85,000 students go to the game.
I don't think they put 85,000 students in the stands, no.
No, I mean, I wonder every school, are they all different? Are they all sort of the same or what?
I'm sure they're all different. And, you know, for all I know, Notre Dame's policy has changed over the years, too, because the school, you know, they've grown. Now, they're, you know, it's still not huge, but so I don't know what the total enrollment is. I could look it up, I suppose.
You know, undergrad's not much different than when we were there.
When I were there, it was like 6,500 undergraduates. You know, I know it expanded to 8,000 at one point. I don't know if it's 10,000 now or what. It's still not huge by major conference school standards, but so they can still afford to put every student in the stands. When it comes... I tell you what is, you know, I don't know if I can extrapolate this to all schools. And again, I'm local. I'm close to Notre Dame. You know, I live over in the area here, and you know, I pretty much go to any sport except football. Football,
oh, yeah.
I go over and tailgate, and I'll go home watching on my couch. I think students, and this is just a terrible generalization, but. My sense is that they turn out for big events, and at Notre Dame, a football game is a big event, you know, and so they show up for that, and it's an all day event, it's tailgating, it's all of that kind of stuff, for basketball, not every basketball game is a big event. So they just don't turn out unless you're playing Duke or North Carolina or, you know, somebody like that. That's a big time game. Otherwise, you're just not going to see the student section full. And then this time of year, we'll see what happens when there's more conference games, which starts now. But when you get, a situation like a last week where, you know, it's snowy, it's really cold, it's Wednesday night, right before Christmas, you ain't going to get anybody except people like me to show up.
Well, plus you're going to get it. They'll throw a 9 o'clock start at somebody for TV, which is absurd.
Yeah, and that obviously has an effect as well. If it's a 9 o'clock start for a Duke game, then yeah, people are still going to turn out, and so it's a big event, and I get a kick out of it because you'll see the student section will be mostly empty, and then it shows up for Duke, and everybody's just going wild. You know, point the camera at us. Here we are, the crazy fans. And they say, go away. You know, you're not.
Well, 9,000 undergrads, 4,000. I'll bet the graduates have to buy the tickets, my guess. 9,000 undergrads probably still get it included.
For basketball? I don't think so.
Football.
Yeah, for football, probably.
Well, because this weekend, you and I have been talking about the, this affects a lot of people because people love to watch it, and it affects me. I know it's probably way too much. Everyone wants to hear this all the time, but what's going on with the NFL now is really, it's an experiment in real time and real money, which I'm really surprised after all this time they're still doing. I mean, all three games Christmas were on, they were on Netflix, right? So at least all three of them were on the same.
Netflix, or if it was Prime, it might have been Prime.
Well,
at
then
least one of the games. One of the games was on Peacock.
Well, I'm talking about on Saturday. That's what I'm saying. If there were the two games, neither one of them was on free TV, but they were on two different places. One was on somebody Prime Plus, and one was, because Audrey, I don't know what she has, but I was going through there looking to find it, and I got to the NFL Network, and the game was on the NFL Network. So yeah. I know she doesn't have that, so it must have been one of the first game was on. So I watched all of that, and she goes, well, we want to go to dinner. I said, well, let's go to Ashford House, and those guys live it on TV. They're the second game. So we get open. Now, the second game, she couldn't get. So on Saturday, it was like 1-1. I don't know who the second one was on. It was Prime Plus, I think. So we get to the Ashford House, and I say to the bartender, you got the game on? We're not paying for it. We're not paying for five other things. This is crazy. And
because last week, you know, they had the usual Fox, CBS, and ESPN/ABC, and they also had games on Netflix, Prime Video, NFL Network, and Peacock.
Well, the one,
so there you go. That is seven networks covered the NFL last week.
Well, I mean, I don't. They must have the statistics by now, in terms of, they obviously are getting enough money for that game for Prime or Peacock to try it out to bump the other guys. So for one off or two off or three off, those people must be paying enough for the, you know, to bump the needle to them. And the NFL at that point probably doesn't care whether they sell commercials or whether they don't. But if they're a loser, it's going to affect them at some point. And when I say this, it comes down to my... there was a guy at Pullman. Boy, I always end up with these weird old stories. And he would go around the world. He was a program manager. Programs meaning, bridges, highways, whatever it was. And he said, when you go out for bid, that you have to, you need to know the bid is good or better as the contractor giving you the bid, if you're any good at what you do. So you should know how many yards of cement, how many tons of steel, how many hours, any special problems. You should be able to come in with a bid that is, you know exactly where these guys are coming. You know, add 10% or 15 or 20% profit to it or whatever. And if somebody comes in high, well, he goes, well, that's one problem. You may have to go out for bid again or something. If it's really a problem if somebody comes in low and wins, because you know he didn't bid enough, you know he's going to lose money, and it's going to bite you in the ass in the end. Because somewhere along the line, he's going to cut on some material, or going to do something. You got to watch him like a hawk. You really don't want that. You almost want to sit down with the guy and say, hey, look, we think you're $3 million under. let me see your math. Yours is wrong or ours is wrong. But so when you sell something to Prime and you know their commercials are going to be less than, you know, than Channel 5, say, or NBC, you have to sit there and say, okay, what is it? What are they in this for? And I'll tell you what, Kevin, there weren't a lot of people in this place, but not one of them had any kind of inclination as this game is so important, we better pony up for Prime right now. Not one. Now, maybe it's an older group or maybe it's something, but I don't see that instinct at all. If it's not on, I'll turn something else. I mean, God, what's this one on? Here's $20. Sign up for it right now so I can watch the next play. I guess some people are doing that, but that's a reach. I think.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. So fortunately, this week, everything is either on ABC, ESPN on Saturday, and then everything's CBS or Fox on Sunday, except for the Sunday night game, which is on NBC. So you can just sit back and catch whatever you want to catch. So I'm trying to I'm cruising the schedule now because I think you're right. How many games that's not your own home market team are you gonna go out of your way to see on a some kind of premium channel or subscription streaming channel? There's none. But so we look at the early games: Saints Falcons, don't really care. Browns Bengals, don't care.
Hey, sorry to interrupt, but why all of a sudden? Why, Kevin? Do you think it seems to me the last two or three weeks is this all injury driven in the NFL? There's teams that you wouldn't even dream are beating teams that are playoff bound and really, really have something to play for. I mean, if the Pittsburgh lost to Cleveland, not even really, well, it might have been close, but and then Atlanta came out of nowhere and beat the Rams. I mean, this is seeming like it's quite a theme in the last couple of weeks.
The Rams lost two in a row, and I don't know that they have a lot of serious, and they certainly don't at among their premium players. I don't know if they have offensive line issues or whatever. I keep going down those early games. I got to make sure that there is just nothing of interest in that. But then you get to the late games. Well, you get the Jets and the Bills. I suppose Bills are playing jockeying for position. Lions Bears obviously matters to us Chicago Bears fans, so that'll be interesting. Chargers Broncos looks like a reasonably I'm having a hard time caring about just about any game here.
Well, see, you got to become one of these guys that rants more than we do. I was reading this article yesterday regarding the incredible online abuse the NFL is getting for scheduling, for flexing the Pittsburgh game into the night game and not the Seahawks and the Seahawks and the 49ers or something. I mean, does anyone...
Yeah, when do they play? Where are they on this schedule?
Well, they got to be 3 o'clock. They're just not the 7 o'clock, I'm thinking. But, I mean, the people... We've been talking the last few weeks about what it's going to take to get, some of the economy moving. I don't want to ask you specific stuff, but how many people do you know, families that you've heard of or know, that have some able-bodied, usually male, lurking at home in their parents' basement at computers all day that has no job whatsoever in their 30s or something? I probably know 5 or 6 that I've heard of them. They're not good friends or anything. They just have people hanging. What is that all about? I heard about the incredible uproar of X and everything else aimed at the NFL for putting the wrong game on. Who cares? One's at 3:30 and one's at 7. What's the difference? What am I missing here?
Yeah, well, you ain't missing anything as far as I'm concerned. By the way, Seahawks 49ers is Saturday night.
Okay.
So they flexed into a primetime game.
I don't think you can do that. The last time I read the flex rules, such as they are, was that you can flex the noon to 3, you can flex the 3 to 7, you can't flex the noon to 7, and you certainly can't flex a day.
Before the last game last Sunday, everybody was TBD on the schedule.
But he can't be. All right, so there was a Saturday game scheduled. There must have been a Saturday game scheduled.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look at that now, and I don't think I have retro ability to do that. You know, I thought it was just all lined up as, you know, date and time were to be determined.
I think you're right. The last week they did that, but so they could do that. But normally, I think, you know, you're not going to have people traveling and all of a sudden do it the day before, unless you tell everybody in advance that might happen. You're right. That's been TBD the whole season. So this has been planned. So I'm not criticizing that. But I say normally, if you're scheduled at noon, you can just get bumped one slot, I think. So if you're scheduled at 3:30, one of those guys can go to 7. But then this is 2 years ago I read it, so it could change. I watched a little bit of the Illinois game last night because there was kind of nothing else on. And we were having kind of a debate at the Triple E Tap. Are any of these teams make any money on this stuff? And they go, okay, well, the team gets money to move the players and the coaches and that from the bowl, but don't they also have to buy the tickets to be able to pay them the money?
Well, they always have. I haven't taken the time to go look, but yeah, it used to be, depending on the bowl game, you had to buy 5,000 tickets, 7,500 tickets, whatever. That was just part of your agreement. You would get paid, and then it was up to you to sell them.
I remember the year in Northern Illinois went to a bowl, and they couldn't sell them, and the state bought them because they wanted them to go to the game. I don't know who they gave them to, but...
Well, and imagine having a $5,000 commitment to go to the... let's pick one here as I'm scrolling the list. Imagine having a 5,000-ticket commitment to be going to some bowl game like Kennesaw State in Western Michigan in the Myrtle Beach Bowl. I mean, road trip to Myrtle Beach, cool. But you know, am I gonna book a trip to Myrtle Beach just to see that football game, or am I just gonna book it whenever I book it?
Where was Northwestern was playing Central Michigan in the Over Under Bowl? Where was that? It was like 2 weeks ago.
I think that was Detroit.
Oh God,
that was the Game Above Sports Bowl. Game Above Sports Bowl, and. Yeah, let's see if I can find out where that was.
Who's still pushing for these bowls? Anybody other than ESPN?
Well, I apparently, ESPN is. Apparently, it was just a big crime, it was so important that Notre Dame play in a bowl game that they just got heavy criticism for not going. So they weren't in the Pop-Tarts Bowl. Jeez.
Well, these people are all over this sport. Your buddy Karl Marx was wrong on one thing for sure. What do you say? Religion was the opium of the people. I think it's sports.
Yeah, and I think you're right. The stupid bowl game that we were just talking about was in Detroit. So they played it at Ford Field, which is where the Lions play. How many tickets do you suppose Northwestern and Central Michigan sold?
I think
a pair of 7-6 teams playing on a Friday.
Well, Northwestern has trouble selling their own place.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah, although I think Northwestern did pretty good with the temporary lakefront stadium. I think they've sold a lot of tickets to that. Or in other words, they had really good attendance because it was very small, so a percentage of attendance was probably good. Plus, they didn't make the students walk anywhere except across campus.
What do you think of this hire of theirs? The guy from Utah.
Oh, Michigan?
Yeah.
That's probably a good hire for them. Kyle Whittingham's a good coach. He's been successful for a long time at Utah, sometimes very successful, sometimes not, you know, but always a consistent winner. And he's an older guy, so they signed him to a 5-year deal. He probably won't coach any longer than that. But they really needed to get their program on solid footing, and he probably can do that for them. Whether he'll come in, be grooming a successor, you know, anything like that. I mean, if I were hiring in their shoes, and you know, they've had enough nagging scandal, not SMU quality or anything like that, but enough nagging scandal going on at their place, and it's not just the football program; it's the, you know, they had some issues with hockey and with basketball coaches as well. I think at some point you just want to get things, you know, get things good, get things respectable, get it cleaned up, and, you know, get on a right path. I think if, you know, much the same as I would if I were in the business world, I think you start saying, okay, let's bring in somebody who's going to, you know, get everything on a good footing, and then let's follow that up by saying, okay, let's start thinking about succession. That's what I'm doing right now is, I'm recruiting for a full-time IT professor, and I want to hire my successor.
But you don't want to take the job too soon. Yours.
What do you mean?
You don't want him, like, to be your successor next week.
Well, it wouldn't be the worst thing. Seriously, if, you know, I need somebody who could take it over at the start of the next fall, the start of the academic year, or the following fall, you know, somebody like that. But, you know, I'd like some maturity, but I'd also like the leadership skills and someone who can buy into my vision of what we're trying to accomplish and then would continue it after I'm done. I did the same thing with being the statewide chair for supply chain management, which I stepped away from that at the end of last summer, because I, you know, that my goals for getting the program, you know, for development of the program were achieved, and I had a really good successor in mind. My department chair counterpart at Lafayette, and he's stepping in and taking it over, and he and I still consult all the time, but I wanted to be able to hand it over to Mike and let him drive it in his direction now, and put his own stamp on it. And I think that's the way you should be thinking in any leadership position, is you always want to know who's going to be your successor, so that if, you know, when it's time for you to move on, whether it's on to bigger and better things or whether it's time to move on to retirement, doesn't matter. You want that person. That's just part of being.
Yeah, what if you last as long as Warren Buffett? You got 20 years. This guy's been waiting for the job.
Well, you know what? You hire people who are ready to move up, and then if there's a time when, you know, the opportunity for them to be your replacement is not imminent, and it's, you know, and the person is ready for something bigger and better, then you help him or her find the next job, wherever that may be, and you get involved in that way, and then you start grooming your next successor.
The guy will be like,
that's just good leadership.
The guy will be like Prince Charles. What do you wait, 70 years?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a little bit of a different situation. He needed somebody to die or abdicate, but, that's just my feeling about it is, and for the IT program, I don't have a successor.
Kevin, would you have liked to?
I've got one guy who's a full-time professor with me, and he's a program chair, which is a leadership position. He does a really nice job with it, but he's almost as old as I am, and Bill's not going to move up, in that way. He doesn't want to, and I've got to work on who's next.
Wouldn't you, if you could think of something in the world that could never happen that you'd love to do, wouldn't you like to hop in a car and drive to Seattle with Queen Elizabeth? Can you imagine the knowledge and the people that lady knew that you would learn in that drive? If she liked you enough to talk to you. I mean, I can't imagine the history in her head. I mean, she knew all these people, good and bad, for how many years? I mean, just unreal, huh?
Oh, yeah, and, experience is a good storyteller, and, it's one of the things that I do in the classroom is I'm a storyteller a lot.
Here's a question for you. I never would hold myself out to be a human resources guy or anything like that. We did some work in college on doing compensation packages, a little bit on writing, designing a resume for somebody. When you talk about this guy coming from Utah for 5 years, now the guy's an older duck, not ridiculous.
Yeah, what is he, 66, 67 years
yeah,
old?
Yeah, but he seems like a successful, nice guy. I'm not so sure in today's world, certainly in his mind. Now, Utah is not a crummy little school by any stretch, but it's also not Michigan. I'm not so sure that I could write a description of who I wanted as a college football coach 3 or 4 years from now, because I have no idea what the scene's going to look like, and I don't know if the skill set is going to match at all with what that coach has to be 3 years from now. I mean, I look at the guy at Notre Dame, you know, Robert, everybody likes him, seems like a good guy, seems to care about people, and right now he's a pretty good coach. I could see this becoming, I could see him in a professional locker room with all his rah-rah crap, and people looking at him and go, what are you talking about? I mean, he's a good guy, so it probably wouldn't happen. When I say this, there was a story that was, you know, everybody at least heard the name Newt Rockne, and, you know, seen the movie, and Ronald Reagan was George Gipp, and, you know, and then George Gipp dies, and we're going to win one for the Gipper, and it's this massive order, and, you know, he was every man's man, right? Knew how to motivate young men and stuff. Well, before all that stuff sort of happened, when he first was starting out, Gipp was his player. Now, in those days, you couldn't write a resume for a coach in those days because the players are 23, 24, 25 years old. And Rack, when he went to Notre Dame, he had worked in the post office for, what, 5 years or something before he decided to go to college? Maybe he was 22, 23, but these are men. They're not 18-year-olds you can yell at, basically. So he goes to give one of these, Notre Dame's losing to somebody at halftime, and he starts one of his speeches, and Gipp said, hey, knock off the shit, Rock. I got 100 hours in this game. You don't have to worry about me playing hard or something along those lines. And he stopped his speech. And after that, he decided the team was never going to be dominated so much by one guy because Gipp was the halfback. He was the best player on defense. By the way, he kicked and he punted. So he was kind of dominated the scene, wouldn't you say? I mean, there aren't too many people like that. You know, maybe a Paul Hornung or somebody. And so, I mean, I don't know that. Does a guy at Utah have any idea at his age, I mean, I say at his age, what exactly he's doing at Michigan? Is he immediately in charge of giving out offers to everybody in the portal? Are they going to hire a general manager, Jim Finks kind of guy, to handle all that for him, or he just gets the players? Does he have input, not have input? I can't even imagine setting this thing up now. How many people is he going to be in charge of the 15 guys to look at every guy in the portal and make deals with everybody and do the stuff with the guys outside and make sure the pizza place is paying your tackle? The job has got to be down to 20% coaching, Kevin. I mean, the whole job, not the coaching part itself. Does he not do the other stuff and just take people that they give him? Does he involve himself in the other stuff, which he's probably never done before at age 66? I mean, I just look at this and go,
I'm sure he's done it at Utah, but I'm sure he's been totally involved in it. But doesn't Michigan, I'm pretty sure Michigan has, you know, they've gone the way of everybody else. They've got a general manager. So that's...
Well, no, they don't.
The general manager has, let me finish. The general manager has people on staff, and portal is part of their job, not necessarily to hire the talent. That's done in collaboration with the coach. But to make sure that they are up to date on everybody who's available, that they have scouting reports on everybody, that, you know, whatever resources are available to evaluate people. They may have recruited them in the past, so they know a lot about them. It may be somebody out of the conference, so you've seen them play before, or you maybe even played against them. But when it gets right down to it, ultimately the coach is going to sign off on who's coming onto the team. You know, that's the dynamic. But that's how, you know, how it's working just about everywhere at this point.
Well, the Memphis team had, how many, what did they have? How many, 70 new people or some number like it? I'm saying to write the skill set down, is it all X's and O's? You're right. The right person can fit into the spot where he's the best at. And if he's not the big X's and O guys, he hires two really good assistants, and they do the sort of like the, you know, the Phil Jackson model. Or I don't believe the guy who takes all the heat, been taking all the heat, is the AD. Because he's been there since the Harbaugh stuff. I mean, I don't know how the hell the guy's still there. They've never once mentioned a general manager that I've read about. That it could be one, or maybe he doesn't have any power. But I mean, I'm saying to design the structure for what it's going to look like 4 years from now is very difficult. Because guess what? We don't know what it's going to look like 4 years ago, Kevin. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I don't know that you want to give anybody an 8-year contract. 8 years from now, that guy might be a fish on water, on dry land, compared to his skill set and what you need, right?
Well, ultimately, the most important skill of anybody in a leadership position like that is the leadership skills. And so, you know, that's going to translate to just about any scenario. Now, I'm looking here. Michigan does have a general manager, but he was hired by the football coach, by Sharon Moore. So I don't know what that relationship's going to be like with Whittingham coming on board, or if he's going to bring his own guy, or if that's going to be kicked up to the to be a report to the AD. I don't know what to tell you about that. I know what the structure is like for Notre Dame basketball, because that is I'm trying to see what we have for football.
Well, how many guys are in the portal in football? Like 1,000, isn't there some huge number?
Yeah, it's a big number. So. So Notre Dame's general manager is a guy named Mike Martin, and he's an experienced personnel executive as the program's general manager, more than 20 years in scouting departments across the National Football League, including the past 4 seasons as director of scouting advancements for the Detroit Lions. So that's one profile of him. Pat Garrity, on the other hand, is for basketball. A former Notre Dame basketball player who was an outstanding player, played 7-8 years in the NBA, had a pretty good little career there too. Garrity was also one of those 3.8 type of students when he was in school, and he worked some in I'm trying to think of which NBA team he worked for quite a while. So he's coming on board with a little bit of that same kind of profile, but he also worked for Bridgewater Associates, which is an investment management firm. He's got a little bit different perspective, but you get different profiles for the general manager. But the general manager's job is to manage the. I can't think of a better term for it. It's to manage the landscape.
Well, some coach is going to want that manager to cut the 1,000 guys possible down to the 100 that he'll take. That he'll go home and study, I'll say, films or whatever you got. And if it's just practice, you don't even have that. And he'll make the decision. Some other guy might say, if you find 10 guys that are really good, just have them show up. I trust you. I mean, was it in the natural? He can't sign anybody. Yeah, he can. When he signed Roy Hobbs, you said if he ever saw anybody he liked, he could sign him, and the manager was all pissed off. I mean, there's all I'm saying is there's many shades of this color here, and to give anybody right now, all I'm saying is to give anybody a 7-8 year commitment, I think is insane. But that's just me.
Well, it's insanity that is unique to college sports in many ways, because. Who signs in the NFL? Who signs coaches for that long, or in the NBA, or Major League Baseball, or any of them? Baseball managers are on 10-year contracts? How many NFL coaches are on 10-year contracts? They just aren't. The professional leagues are a lot smarter about that. Colleges. Maybe it's because of volume that there are just too many job openings every year, so that they have to protect their guys. They have to keep them locked up. There's got to be a better way for them. But who am I to say? However they see fit, I guess.
Well, the reason why I ask is we've had this year Stocks and Jacks, and by the way, I want to thank you for being one of our most loyal people, and we've. we've argued like we always do, all the people, but I think we've covered some of the most amazing topics. We did all that stuff on the veterans, and we're doing a lot of stuff now with, in the last few weeks, it may not seem all that obvious, is what is your view of the world going forward? And what do you think, you know, individual people at different levels of society are going to see for their future? And you're going to see, you know, you see, you know, the stealing going on, you see crime issues, you see this, then you have a person from like the head of General Mills coming on the other day and saying, well, they were interviewing the chairman, and he goes, 80-85% of our customers are essentially hurting, so we've been lowering prices of all the stuff like in the cereal aisle and everything, because the other 15% of the people who got, you know, are doing fine. You know, he didn't say they have more money than God, but he sort of implied that. And, you know, the question is, what is your view of the future? And we have the guy from, what's his name? Not the Asian name, but I'll say the ethnic name from California, the representative lobbing this thing about a wealth tax.
Oh, you're talking about Ro Khanna. Yeah,
yeah. He's lobbing this thing about a wealth tax, which, as I talked to Kenny Polcari yesterday, I don't want a wealth tax, but if you just get out of your own drawers for once, I mean, think for everybody and not just yourself, and I'm not accusing you or our listeners of doing that. The government is friggin' broke, okay? And you see a lot of people that have an amazing amount of wealth. Unlike 50, 60 years ago, most of the wealth has, quote, not been earned. And I won't say, it's probably the wrong way to say it, Kevin, but it's appreciation of investment stuff, which it's not like somebody, the whole neighborhood is making 100 grand a year, and oh, by the way, you can live on 40 and everybody's putting 60 in the bank. That's not what's happening. I mean, there are people that make dough and save and do that kind of stuff. But the fact is, you're not coming up with $5 million of retirement because you saved it, okay? If you, it's either through a 401k and you were smart enough to get, or smart enough or lucky enough to be in some of the right stuff, and you've ridden the wave of this, I'll use the term wealth, I won't say bubble because it may not be a bubble. It's the people that I met out in Mellon Bank in Philadelphia that were the trust fund babies, and they'd come in and fight with the guy about not paying the maid, where they got all the stock from the old man 60 years ago, and they got their 50,000 shares of Apple or IBM or something, and all of a sudden they're multi-zillionaires and never worked a day in their life. There's, if you look at where the money is, where the wealth is, it's not in salaries. I mean, there are some people it is, obviously, but not too many. And so when you talk about where do you get revenue from when you're broke, you sit there and say, well, can I really get anything more out of the guy making 60 grand a year who's bringing the coupons to the store? The answer is probably no. Now, if you look at somebody who, you know, and this is not a disparagement, but if you look at somebody that when their old man died, didn't even have to pay tax on the stock that he had his whole life, and now it's up another 50% with you, if you're looking for money, that's where it is, Kevin. If you're looking for wealth, if you're looking for something to tax, I don't want it. I'm in the business where I don't want my guys having to pay a wealth tax. What is that going to do for me? But I'm saying, if you look at where the dough is, if you open your eyes and say, where can I actually get it, other than corporations that are still overseas, and you know, the big Trump tax bill in his first term actually made it easier for somebody to put money over, keep money overseas than not. I mean, unless you're willing to do that, in order to get the money, what was the old line? Why do you rob banks? So that's where the money is, right? I mean,
but you know, I hear what you're saying, that's you know, that's where there is something left to tax, but that doesn't mean you go tax it. Because,
I understand that. I'm saying I started this out by saying I was having trouble with hell yesterday. I was agreeing with him, but that's always a problem. I mean, I don't like it, Kevin, but if you look at where it is, if you went two generations with this, you'll never pay taxes on $50 billion of increased NVIDIA funds. I mean, right? I mean,
the question is, why are we there? Right? Isn't that, you know, why are we there? You know, is there a way to rationalize the tax system better? And I think that's a legitimate question, because it is all in the details. When we talk, know, in public discussion, we talk about the tax rates all the time. Well, here's the rate on wealthy people. Here's the rate on corporations. Look, if I can take my my taxable income and get it to zero or near zero, what do I care what the rate is?
Right. Well, what I'm saying here is one of the biggest change ever, biggest sort of wealth leaving the floor in my era. When I say leaving the floor, leaving the options exchange, was not the crash of 87, even though that was a bad day for me, was the Tax Act of 1984. And you might say, why would that be, Buffalo Breath? Well, before that, market makers were taxed as if they were retail clients. And every day, we had positions all over the floor. I had three guys, we had positions in all these different stocks. And I would get this thing every morning called a status. With every single trade we had done listed in what the price of the trade was. Now, why would they do that? Because we were taxed on completed sales, like retail people. And by the way, I'm not advocating this. I'm just saying how it could be different, Kevin. We were taxed on completed sales. So there were people who had option market-making facilities just to roll taxes. They maybe owned a metalworking facility. So if I put it, for instance, if I put on the, pick a stock that moves a lot, I don't know if it moves that much, let's just say IBM, I would put on a spread, I'd buy the stocks at 302, I'd buy the 200-210 call spread for, $9.99 or something. You say, okay, why the hell would you do that? Because if the stock moves $50, one of the ones I bought is going to be a $50 winner, and one is going to be a $50 loser, right? So if I close the losing transaction on today, say, New Year's Eve, I've got this massive loss in this one trade, even though there was nothing economic about it. And I can net out all my gains from my really good year I had everywhere else. So all of a sudden they said, oh, no, if you're a trader, if you're if you're in the system, if this is your livelihood, here's how we're going to do your taxes. If you started out the year with $2 million in your account and you ended up the year with $3 million in account, guess what? You made $1 million. That's what you're paying your tax on. So we were essentially marked to market. You paid on your mark to market stuff. And right now, by the way, if you started trading a bunch, and we have people here that could do that, that trade a lot, but don't, you can actually take that election as a professional trader, as a retail trader. If you're going to trade all the time, you could take the election that you are a professional trader and you are no longer marked only when you sell something. So could there be another way? Again, this is not advocating. This is just educating. Could there be another way? Yeah, there is for everybody who's a professional right now. I mean, you could say to somebody who bought IBM last year, it had a huge year, say you bought IBM, you bought $300,000 in IBM, and now it's worth $400. Guess what? You owe tax on $100. That's what everyone professionally does. Retail people, not only do they get to hang on to stuff forever, if they croak, they can give it to their kids and never pay any taxes, and I guess if they croak, they give it to their kids. Okay, well, there's something there. Do I want to see somebody pay that taxes? No, I don't want to see anybody pay any taxes. But it's not like there isn't a way to do this, Kevin. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Well, you also mentioned, too, and just to shift the conversation a little bit, when you say, well, that's where the if you're looking for places to raise tax money, that's it. If you want another place to raise tax money, why don't you look at government spending, too? And that's, that's a whole new can of worms where, inch, step by step, inch by inch, slowly we turned. Step by step, inch by inch, we have just gotten into this, bureaucratic state that was never intended in the design of the government.
You know what I'm going to say, Kevin? Don't take this personally. There's something to that, but it's nothing. I mean, virtually, I wish I still could find it. You talk about government expenditures, most all go for either to people or for things. If you got rid of 20% of the people in Washington, if you could, make it 40%, you save 1% of the budget. everybody's got this idea that if we just canned a few people somehow or another, and they don't do anything anyway, because by the way, I heard that on TV, somehow or another we'd be even. No, we're not even close. We're not even close to that. I mean, right now we got $1 trillion.
I agree with you, and cutting the bureaucracy is important, but it's not as important, this year since it was a little over 3 million federal employees in November of 2024. November 2025, it's 2.7 million. So, we have done a lot of cutting. Now, part of, you talked about this earlier this week, when you're saying when you cut people, you're cutting salaries, but you're also cutting all the people-related expenses, whether desks, telephones. Yeah. But that's not even it. It's cutting the bureaucracy, but it's also, but that's not what I'm even discussing. What I'm saying is, how much stuff are we just funding because somebody thinks it's a good idea? Just because something's a good idea doesn't mean you go, okay, let's go.
Well, I'm going to say that the amount of money.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, Larissa, how you doing?
How are you,
good
Larissa?
Morning. Happy New Year's
Happy
Eve.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year's Eve, and Happy New Year next year too. The whole year, not just one day.
Well, I'd like to jump in on the government.
Please do.
I think it's a challenge because we don't necessarily know what the metrics are to see if these programs are successful. Are they achieving what the goal is? And I don't think that information is transparent to the public. So when we talk about these things and we're thinking about whether or not this is a good program or not a good program, or whose idea is it, or how is this coming about, we don't even understand the impact that it's supposed to make, let alone whether or not it's actually achieving that impact. So that information isn't readily available. So as a populace, we don't have the ability to make any kind of judgment call of whether or not the government is succeeding in some of these things.
Well, I just
I agree with you on that, and I think that's part of it, but there's also the part of it that says, when I look at my personal budget, and this is just a mindset, just because there is something that would be a good idea and would be, worth doing, doesn't mean I can afford to do it. And,
absolutely.
That's where my head is. Even if it's good, even if it will be effective, do we have the wherewithal to do it? And if we don't, then you just can't do it.
Sure.
And we do a lot of this just by funding NGOs, so we don't even have the it isn't just that we don't have the data as you clearly pointed out, it's not the government's data to measure anymore. we've handed off not only the funding, but we've handed off the ability to articulate whether it's an effective program or not. We've handed that off to third parties as well.
Well, we have. I'm not so sure that this is two things that kind of rub me the wrong way. And Melissa, you're not doing this. So, is the idea that?
No. She absolutely rubbed you the wrong way.
It's like this. Everybody in government, I read somewhere or heard on TV, not one of them does a day's work. Get rid of them. I never met them. They're useless. Well, I really have a problem with that, because I think a lot of people in Washington actually show up and do what they're supposed to do and actually try and do a good job. So the idea that you would disparage, and I'm saying either one of you are doing it, but there are some things. Listen, maybe you're one more historically oriented.
Let me
finish
your
saying. There used to be, when I was very young, I never was an attorney, there used to be something called, I don't know what it was called, where if you put together a bill in Congress, and maybe this is before they had the 90 zillion page bills, there was something, it was like a review process 6 months, 8 months, a year after, where the GPO or somebody would come in back and say, here's the bill, here's how it's actually working, and guys would go back and they would have almost an adjustment review of the bill if it wasn't doing what it was supposed to do. And I have not heard of that in four decades. Have either of you? There's no, it seems like, where I agree with you 100%. There's no review on any of this stuff. It doesn't appear. There has to be, though. How can there not be any?
Well, there is some GAO review. I mean, that comes out. It doesn't get a lot of publicity when it does. But, you know, we have all kinds of programs where they come back and say, okay, here's what it's really costing, which is not nearly the same as what it was as the original scoring when the bill was presented for passage. But, you know, it's hard to make things go away once they exist. But, and Larissa will tell you this, we're in Indiana, you know, we're facing some of that thought process right now, where all the public schools, the public post-secondary education, has gotten squeezed this time around on you know, budgetarily, because we sort of Indiana was so well run for such a long time in terms of managing the budget, but that got away from them, and now, you know, Braun is trying to deal with it, and, you know, we're seeing that in terms of getting squeezed on the budgetary side in post-secondary education, and it doesn't feel good, but I know why it's happening, and it's happening because the money's not there, and we don't want to raise people's taxes.
I'll lob this one at Larissa. If you were going to put together a constitution, mm-hmm. It's a conversation I had with Dr. J years and years ago. If you actually go, I'm not telling you anything, you're a professor. If you go through the numbers, the biggest stresses on any government, be it city, county, state, even federal, the biggest stresses are going to come when times are bad. And those are also the times when they're going to have the least revenue, the way they get the revenue, right? So you almost need some sort of a
education, in which case we are countercyclical to that. But keep going.
Well, but I'm saying in general, that's the case. I mean, you're going to have your biggest unemployment spending the day your tax returns from your tax from people employed are going to be the lowest, right? Well, duh. I mean,
yeah, I agree.
So it seems like you almost need, I don't know, you have a law like this that when times are quote good by somebody's definition, you need to have some sort of a buffer, some sort of a rainy day fund. And does anybody know a state that ever has one? I mean, it seems like they spend every nickel on the best year. That's the problem, I think, in some ways, isn't it?
I think it's a huge problem. It's exactly where how Indiana got into trouble. That was during the Holcomb administration. It was hey, we're flush. Let's go. Let's rock and roll.
So I'd like to jump in on a couple points.
Please do.
I think, the expression fear the boom. And I think this is one of the repercussions of that, of when things are good, we're so easy to ignore the long-term consequences of what we're doing. But it's interesting that you brought up the Constitution. I think most of the major changes in the Constitution don't necessarily come from financial crisis, but social crisis.
Right, I would agree. I mean, by the way, what is Indiana's? When was the last time they had a constitutional convention? Illinois had one when you and I were in high school. They at least had one in our lifetime. Indiana, does theirs date back to the original one?
I have no idea.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. No clue here either.
Listen, here's a question for you. What we were talking about, this kind of wealth bubble.
Before you ask that question, yeah. I want to leave that point. I think it's a great point that it is just so easy when things are good to lose the discipline. I think both of you have made that point, and I've seen it in private sector. Where I've seen the same thing happen is when you lose the discipline when things are going well, it's just so easy to say, yeah, good idea, go for it, and then you really, really need to actually, that's when you need to be the biggest SOB when it comes to spending money, so that you do have something left over for the rainy day. Okay, go ahead and ask your question, Tom.
Well, and I'd like to piggyback on that, and especially like in today's economy with the K economy right now, on the surface, it looks like our economy is doing very well. Asset prices are up. Things, when you aggregate things, it looks like we're doing very well. There's a group of people, as you have, we're discussing in the first hour, that are doing very well, and a group of people who are not. So it's also very challenging of defining what is a good time period, because for some people right now, this is a fabulous time period. And for a lot of people, it's not. So I think that's also another challenge of how do we define what's good? How do we define what's bad? How do we break it into segments so that we can have a better understanding of what's really happening? Because if we're not doing that, our economy looks like it's doing very well, particularly if we're focused on asset prices.
Well, Arisa, if you have, it is a shot at this administration, but it's also a shot at all the ones that came before it. If you continue to creep money into the system and lie about your CPI, you're never going to have a nominal recession. It's always going to look good, even though if you look at the median person, it may not be good. And how do you bounce past those numbers other than enough people saying, wait a minute, I don't care what you're telling me, it's not, you know, what's the saying, don't pee on my shoes and tell me it's raining, right? Where are we? And I kind of want to lead into, Kevin and I were talking about, the bane of me is everything's the same subject. When you talk about the wealth, I'll use the term bubble, but it may not be a bubble, and you look at what's going on in college sports and skyboxes and ticket prices, and yet you have other people saying, I'm never going to be able to go to another game again. What happens if we were to get a 20 or 30% drop in the market, or 40%? Does every NBA star get a cut in pay because nobody can pay the commercial? I mean, how vulnerable are we to this, I guess, is my question.
I don't think we're very vulnerable at the moment. I think the administration is looking to maintain those asset prices and will set rates and set policies to do so.
I agree with you, but the operative word was if. Can they push it out longer? Yeah, but I mean, can things stay overvalued? Why, it's like having the big house where the sand is washing away under the house. I mean, are we at that stage yet?
I wouldn't be surprised if we were, and I know for a lot of people, it probably feels that we are. And I think because we have elected officials that they are going to work to keep asset prices up so that they can continue this facade that the economy is doing very well.
Well, so where's the danger there? I mean, I would say
besides
that
financial collapse.
Well, I mean, I think the danger is in the amount of income or the amount of interest rates they're going to have to pay. I mean, if they continue to, I mean, the last three rate cuts have not budged the 10-year at all. Matter of fact, it's up a little, isn't it? I mean, very slightly. So if they continue to pour money in and people get an idea that inflation is going to happen, your 10-year rates could actually go up. So if the cost of running the government, right now we're at a trillion something. Our interest rates are bigger than our defense budget right now, our interest cost. Well, if all of a sudden you end up with an 8.5% 10-year rate, I could think that they can try and push the asset bubble as much as they want, but they're going to have a problem with that. I mean, when I came into the business, the Dow was 800 and the rates were 12.5. I don't want to see that again.
No.
And I'm just saying, how much, what is the vulnerability? I mean, what started all this, if you were listening, was a gentleman in California talking about a wealth tax. And the idea that I, for one, don't want to see that, but I surely understand where he's coming from. Because there's people that have made, basically millions and millions of dollars in their lifetime, never had a job, right? They've just seen the assets. And by the way, if I would have gotten, a million shares of IBM from my stepfather, I wouldn't be complaining. But all of a sudden now that, I've made, $40 million in my lifetime and I've never got off the couch. Well, if you're looking for where the revenue is, well, there it is, right? I mean, I'm not saying you want to do that. I hope nobody takes this home and saying, this chief guy's been saying we need a wealth tax. I don't, but I mean, looking at it logically, where's the dough? That's where it is, right?
Well, and that also supports the idea that it's a counter to the federal government supporting asset prices going up. And they say it's a reaction to and saying, okay, if this is where wealth is coming from, we're supporting the idea that we should have policies specifically to raise asset prices, then eventually somebody needs to pay taxes on these to offset those costs for the bottom half of the K.
I think that's where this guy is going. It sounds very unpopular, which it is, right?
It is, and it is for a number of reasons, but probably the biggest reason that it is because the wealth that they want to tax is wealth that is much more easily moved into a non-taxable location. So, you know, if you want to tax wealth, watch investment move out of the United States, and that's going to be your problem. Is you know, the people you want to tax are the ones that are the best with tax strategies.
Well, yeah, that's always kind of the problem. I would agree with that.
It's a huge problem. It's very similar to what I said earlier, that, you know, we can talk about tax rates all you want. If I can get my taxable income to near zero, you know, completely independent of the cash flow, which is very positive, then what do I care? Go ahead, raise it to 50%. What do I care? 50% of zero is still zero.
Well, and you can then have a net income of zero, right? And then you can, if you're a politician, champion these wealth taxes, because you know it's not going to actually impact you, and then you can look like a hero. So it's a unique opportunity also for politicians to maintain their office.
Well, that's what, when you look at what both sides, you know, and Kevin accused me of not being in the middle. I'm not in either party these days. They both have their routine. Neither one of them really comes to the fore and solves any sort of problem. They just favor their side versus the other. And yet the people, you know, the numbers just never seem to change. And Carl, to his blessing or to my curse, has got me looking at things, and I think you as an economist maybe do the same thing. If you look at the 2025-year chart on all this stuff, you almost can't tell when one person came into office and the other on the gross numbers. But you can tell, if you look at, you know, who the president was at the time, which side gets favored for a while, then the other side gets favored for a while, because they both have the group that essentially they think put them in. So you're going to see a difference in favoritism and who gets what, but you're not really going to see any difference in the major numbers, right? I mean, Bush essentially doubled the deficit during his era. Obama doubled the deficit in his era. Trump was well on his way his first term. Biden was on his way, and now Trump's doing it again. So if you look at the numbers, you can't even tell who's in and who's out. Am I right or not? Right.
Yep, that's right.
And it's just a question of, okay, Trump's going to favor the people he thinks put him in, and Biden did the same thing. Yet the poor guy in the middle is sitting there going, wait a minute, this is getting worse and worse. I don't know what you do when you're, I'll dig it up here, but this $1.8 trillion number and interest every year, that's, I don't know, if that goes to $3 trillion, what are we going to do? I mean, where does that money come from? Are we just going to be like the Weimar Republic or what? Just put more and more money into the system? I don't know how you, are they going to have to renege? I mean, what are they going to have to do? I mean, look at, I don't know where this, there doesn't seem to be any urgency other than the three of us and a few other people on the show, and Russell and those kind of, I've got, where are we? Your interest on debt is $967 billion this year. The Defense Department of War, whatever you want to call them, are $934. So our interest costs are bigger than our defense costs. That's a number.
It's been a problem, and it's been a problem on we've been moving towards that for a long time.
I would argue even decades we've been moving toward that problem, and either we're going to continue to pump money into it, or we're going to face a severe correction. And nobody wants to feel the correction.
I mean, and my question is, since we've never seen anything quite like this, certainly not in my era. And I guess you have to go back to 29, which I've only read about. Kevin, what was it like in 29? I guess I'm not sure, because so much money is in this wealth package. What a 40% drop in, I mean, you know, in 2000, for those that don't remember, the QQQs, which is now 618, QQQs were like 125, and I think they went down to 25. We're not talking about went from 115 down to 105. They went to 25. So the same thing today, if that were to happen, it would be 618 down to like 150. I have to believe that ticket prices to the Bulls are going to be down if that happens. Just saying. I mean, I don't think it could possibly happen without affecting everybody, would it?
I think it would impact everybody. I'm sorry, Kevin.
No, keep going. You finish the thought, and then I'll jump in.
No, I think it will absolutely start to impact everybody. And again, that's part of where the correction comes in. And it will be uncomfortable. And when people stop spending money, one of my big concerns, and my sister's up in Minnesota right now, and she visited the Mall of America, and she said, consumerism is alive and well. And that has me very concerned that people are continuously spending money that they don't have. And they're racking up more consumer debt. What I think the consumer debt levels are around the 2008 levels, if not higher. And we're then pushing back all of these problems by creating additional amounts of ballooning debt. So now you've got a potato that could potentially, you pay how much ever for a potato, then you pay it back 6 years later and it's cost you how much more. I think that these are going to become issues, and then people will eventually have to stop spending money at going to the Chicago Bulls, which would be a travesty to the Chicago Bulls. However, it would start to contract the economy.
I've got credit card debt right now is $1.3 trillion.
Woo.
That's a number. Per holder is $8,000, $8,100.
Oh, my word.
When you say that, when somebody makes an observation, and I have a feeling your sister's pretty bright on this stuff, but can you really make an observation like that and have it rigorous? I mean, the fact that people go to the mall and it's crowded, do you really know if they spent more than they did last year, or they went there for, last year would have been 4 presents and this year it's 3? I mean, can you really tell by obviously if there are people there, it's better than if there's no people there. I get that part. But I mean, I have a couple of friends in the restaurant business, and one guy was telling me one night, he goes, you walk by this place and you think, well, I'm doing great. And I tell you what, I'm not. He goes, I have $60 bottle of wines on the menu and I've got $20 ones. This is a while ago. And he goes, the $20 ones are pretty good. He goes, I've not sold a $60 one in 3 weeks. And he goes, the amount of desserts I'm selling are way down. And that's where all my profit is. If somebody has one bottle of wine at a table, one appetizer, and dinner, I break even. If they have 2 desserts and 2 bottles of wine, I make money. So it's really kind of hard sometimes to, unless you're the person in the store, the place is packed, but nobody's buying it. I mean, I'm not accusing your sister of not knowing what she's talking about. I mean, but how do you know whether last year a person spent $100 and this year they spent $80? I mean, it's kind of hard to get these numbers, isn't it?
It is, and people aren't necessarily forthcoming or truthful about these numbers.
I would agree.
I mean, I like to pretend that I spent less, but I don't know that that's true. And in my mind right now, I'm sticking with it, that I spent less on Christmas than I did last year, because that makes me feel good. And so I think that's also another part of the trickiness of the number that we're looking at. And I think my sister's point was partly because of the number of packages she's been walking around with, or the other people were walking around with.
What do you think? Is there any sort of a delineation between people going to the Mall of America instead of going to, Needless Markup or someplace? I mean, the fact that people are at more of a discount mall, is there a message there or not?
Well, I personally like discount malls. At the Rosemont Outlet Center, I think the Friday before Christmas, and it was packed.
Really? Is that place any good? I've never been there. I've never been to that one.
I thoroughly enjoy it. But it was packed to the point where there were a couple of stores that I walked into, looked at the line, and thought, I'm not going to even shop here.
Wow.
And that I'm specifically thinking of the store Nike, because I like Michael Jordan, and I thought it'd be fun to get my kids some Michael Jordan stuff. But the line, and again, I don't know if people are spending more or less, but the line at the Nike store was easily 20 people deep. Lululemon, the same. I walked into Lululemon and looked at the line, and I thought, it's not, for me personally, not worth it to actually go in and shop because of how long that line is. I don't have the patience to wait 20 minutes for to make a purchase.
Last time I was at the one in Michigan City, the Lakeside Mall, or whatever they call it, there was a huge line for the Nike store as well. What are they doing, giving stuff away in there or what? Are people just like Nike?
I don't know that they were.
Yeah,
I don't have the patience to get through the parking lot before I even get into the mall. So.
Sure.
Kevin, I don't think you and I would ever be in the Shoppers Hall of Fame.
Definitely not. You know, I'm one of those people that, you know, will walk into a store, I need, you know, a pair of pants or something. Look on the shelf. Yeah, that's the right size. That's the right color. Out of here. Let's go.
That's exactly well.
I have a very low willingness to shop is the marketing term.
Because I'm quite the opposite. A lot of the stores that I shop frequently, they know me by name. I went into my old Costco and a bunch of people came up and gave me hugs. So I think of that Cole Hand store on Michigan Avenue. Once invited me to their Christmas party.
they're a different shopper. there are people that would go into the difference between males and females historically and why that is, but we probably won't do that.
Sure.
But even, you know, even you can go into the traditional men's store and, you know, they bring you out, you know, three or four of everything so that you can choose, probably hoping that you went in to buy one and you're going to walk out with three. But,
sure.
There is a different shopping experience that, you know, just doesn't fit my willingness to shop for it.
Well, funny you should mention that. I actually have to go to a wedding tonight, of all things, and needed a shirt and a new pair of pants and... So I go to this men's store in Orland, and it's very nice. She couldn't have been 25 years old. Young black lady comes up. What do you need? And I said, I need shirt and pants. She goes, okay, try these on. Try this on. I went in the changing room. I walked out. I said, I'll take them both, and went out the door. she had the rights. I had no more interest in looking at anything else than the man on the moon. She goes, well, can I help you or anything else? No, this is what I came for. See you. Thank you. And she was terrific. I'm like, they both fit, amazingly enough, and walked out the door and said, I'll see you next time.
What's that, like 4 years down the road, Tom?
Well, I thought I'd never have to wear a suit again, but I guess I have to for this wedding tonight. So, God. It's really hard to get your finger on just what the pulse of the economy is. And I think that some of the things I see happening, in the trading part, I was mentioning to Kevin earlier, I don't know if you've watched any of the metals this week. The move in silver the other night, where all of a sudden you see silver is up like $5. It's trading $80. I started the year at, I'm thinking 30 or 40 or something. You come in and it's down $5. So it had like a 15% swing in the day. And now today, China's putting some sort of a ration on silver exports. And you see these kinds of moves and the headlines that are driving them, and regular people don't get the headlines when other people get the headlines, and this whole thing seems like it's becoming a bizarre world to me. It's been really good for my clients because we actually were in a lot of the metals for a lot of the people the last 3-4 months of it. They've the best 3-4 months. Now, did I do it? No. If you would ask me, in August when people have their silver stuff, I'd say, we might get to 38 by the end of the year if we're doing good. Well, guess what? It's trading 66. I didn't do that. I didn't get in the way of it, thank God. But when you see this kind of stuff, you just wonder. It's like this wealth just flies back and forth. If I have a guy who wants to maybe do some copper futures through me, I go, you know how big these things are? They're 25,000. They're 25,000 pounds a contract. So if somebody does something, some tariff on copper moves a dollar, it's 25 grand for a one lot. Somehow or another, this big money stuff is getting so big money, you almost can't get your hands around it. And every time this has happened before, it hasn't ended well. I get in this weirdo view of what's going on this next year, and I just am kind of afraid of it. Am I just being nuts here or no? Tell me I am, please.
Oh, I'm happy to tell you you're nuts anytime. No, that's what, you know, I do that regularly.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Keeps me grounded.
I'm going to jump off and let you two finish up. I wish you both and all of our listeners a happy new year. And I will, let me see, today's Wednesday. I'll talk to you in 2 days. I'll be back on Friday.
Yep.
Larissa, happy new year, Kevin.
Larissa, all this stuff I'm worried about, is it just because it's my job to be worried for people, or is it because there seems to be some darkening clouds here?
I have been worried about this for easily 3 years. So you are not alone. I'm also very concerned with where the economy is going. I'm very concerned with just the overall lack of understanding of how it impacts actual people. So I think that's something that's quite ignored frequently. And that really upsets me and concerns me. I'm concerned with, you know, you're talking about these huge lots. Well, most people can't trade these things, right? And so we're now limiting the access for most people if they want to get in and even participate in the markets. I'm also concerned about the lack of fundamentals for some of these asset classes. I hosted a volatility competition. This was several years back when I was with Illinois Institute of Technology. TD Ameritrade was our sponsor.
Oh, good for you. All right.
And, you know, I had students place trades. TD Ameritrade provided the data and the platform. But really it came down to, and I don't want to say this tactful there in a poor way, but it was almost dumb luck. So I had students, and it just by happen chance was silver, get into silver. It had a huge move within this time frame that the competition ran. They placed one trade, and they had made the most money. Did they do any fundamental analysis? Did they have any insight on what silver was doing? No. It was just dumb luck, and I think that's a concern. I also think it's a concern that it might not be dumb luck and that something else is happening behind the scenes. So I'm with you. I'm very concerned for the economy and what's going to come up for the next year.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about. What do you say we go to the last break of the year, huh?
Woohoo!
We'll have Andrew a chance to give his last traffic news and sports for the year. S&P futures down 5, NASDAQ futures down 25. We've been leaking to the downside this week, which is not usual for this time of the year. Not crazy, just down, been down like 3-4 days in a row, which, like I said, doesn't much happen. Be right back, Stocks and Sharks.
This is a true sad story for ADT, the leader in home security systems. My favorite dog, Oliver, was stolen from our garage recently. If I had a camera system installed in my home from ADT, I would have known exactly what car possibly pulled up in my driveway and stole my little friend. If I had a security system from ADT, my dog would still be here. I called ADT this weekend, and they're coming out in a few days to install a camera and a new security system. Unfortunately, it's a little too late for me. Listen, protect everyone you love in your family. Call ADT now. Have them come out and give you a quote to install a full security system in your home. Don't let it be too late for you. Call right now.
Paid for by the Home Security Hotline. 800-200-6543. 800-200-6543. 800-200-6543. That's 800-200-6543.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks,
stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Andrew on the board. S&P futures down 6, NASDAQ futures down 29. So, well, slow here this morning. It is a full day. We don't never get a half day on New Year's Eve. So it's a full day for the market. Dow futures down 32 over in Europe. The guys were up yesterday. Today, DAX up 139. That's 6.6%. FTSE down 9. That's 0.1%. CAC around down 18.2%. So, wait a minute. DAX is not open today. They're closed for some reason. All right, so we can't put that one up here. So belay that on the DAX number. That was yesterday's number. Over in Asia, Nikkei, again, they're not open today either. These are 12:30 numbers. Same thing with the Hang Seng is open. They're down 224.9%. Shanghai is open or up 3. Call that flat. So a couple places that are closed today. Bonds up 2 ticks on the 10-year, 4.15. Again, the 10-year has not budged at all down with the last 3 rate cuts by the Fed. The Bund unchanged, 2.86. Japan is over 2%, 2.06. And who would have thunk that after how many years those guys were like 0 or 0.1% or something? That's high for them. Oil up 40 cents, but still in the 58s, 58.35. Brent up 38 cents, 61.71. And we've been asking everybody on the show, with oil down this low, is are those companies maybe a buy this year? You know, who knows? I mean, you would be buying low on the oil sub. Gold down 47 bucks, 43.38. It's been very volatile this week. Silver down 6.49. It's 8%, another 8% move. 71.44. This traded $80 Sunday night. So that's a number. Foreign exchange, the dollar has been down. Now look at this. The euro is over 117, almost 117.5. So the dollar has been low lately, based on what people think the government's going to do on the interest rates. Same thing with the pound, 134.5. Crypto up 695, back up to 88,645. So Bitcoin's had a little bit of a resurgence this week after having a crummy quarter. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 7:38 here in Chicago, Wednesday, December 31st. It's just a little bit of sports here. The TCU won the Alamo Bowl yesterday, leading the game 30-27 against UCS. Over to Chicago weather, it is currently 30 degrees right now. It's going to be cloudy, breezy, and on and off cold throughout the day. We're going to have some snows and flurries on and off as well. About an inch of snow and probably some slippery roads. Over in Phoenix, they're just a little bit warmer. They're at 54 degrees. Their high's going to be a whole lot warmer. Their high's going to be a whole lot warmer at 73 degrees. They're going to have a sun and area of clouds throughout the day. Then finally, for Chicago traffic, things are looking pretty light. Got basically no accidents to report, definitely, and barely any traffic to report. If you're on the inbound Kennedy from the Jane Byrne to, from O'Hare to the Jane Byrne, if you're coming in from Deerfield, or if you're coming in from Thorndale, basically all those routes are going to take you about 20, 25 minutes. That's all I got.
So nobody's at work. No point in turning back. There's nobody here.
Yep. Only you.
Lisa, are you in Purdue? Or where are you? Are you there or are you here?
I'm in Purdue.
You're at Purdue? What's everybody's on break, I assume.
I'm technically working from my house.
Okay. What makes you the most nervous? I mean, what would be a tell where you'd make you even more nervous? I mean, I think that your people that are generally pretty bright and have their eyes on the world are pretty good on direction, but we're all pretty bad on timing, right? I mean, you've seen kind of a ghost for 3 years. I remember when I started the business, the market was 800. I go, boy, this thing's got to go straight up. It was about 18 months before it went up. So, I mean, if you're observant, you're also kind of early usually, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. I don't think people want these bad things to happen. So they, what is it? It's the picture of the duck where they're kicking really hard to keep themselves afloat.
Yeah.
I think that's what's also happening. My biggest concern is what's going to happen to people. So if we're really looking at an average person having a debt of $8,000 credit card debt, and they're living paycheck to paycheck, you can only assume that credit card debt is going to grow. And there will come a point for people's personal finances where things are going to get really tight. And I think if people are out there listening, they might say to me, but things are already really tight. My concern is for individual people, it's going to get worse. And I think that is my biggest genuine concern. Granted, asset prices, that the decline in asset prices is never good for us in the financial markets. But I think it's more important to really look at, again, those individual households.
Well, I would absolutely agree. I don't, but nobody wants to do that, do they?
No, it's uncomfortable. right? It's that uncomfortableness where we really should start thinking about how are we going to create a correction and how do we create a soft landing for that correction?
Right.
And I don't think people want to talk about those things. I think they want to talk about how do we keep asset prices up, as opposed to saying, let's see how can we start to slowly unwind this and start to create that contraction so that the two legs of the K can start to come together. So we're not in this situation where half of our population is just struggling, and eventually we'll start to have to choose between food and healthcare and things along those that nature, because that's not a good place to be.
Well, you know what you're, what you are describing is this. We've only been here, well, I'm a huge student of all this history, but we've only really been with this dichotomy in wealth in this society one time, and that was in the 20s. I really don't want it to end like that, do you?
No. And that's why I think the conversation about how do we create that soft landing? What can we do to start to take a little bit off the edge so that we can start to really proactively think about, if something happens, what are we going to be doing? What can we be doing now to prepare for that? Because it will eventually happen, not necessarily something like the from 29, but 2008, 2001, those were bad years.
Yeah. Well,
if
you were to take if I were to take what you say as gospel, by the way, I'm pretty close to that. Doesn't mean I don't try and argue to get even more information out of you. If you and I were going to engineer the, quote, soft landing and try and look at all the things that are kind of messing people up and put an 8-point plan together, how unpopular would we be?
Oh, very unpopular.
We'd be kicked out with
Like
when, but is that, we'd be treated like an old boot, as one of my traders used to say.
Well, and like one of the things that I would love to put out there is limits for personal debt.
Well, I mean a lot of people, when you say that, now there's always going to be, talk about the K person, there's always going to be somebody who, And I choose to not believe this, and I could be totally wrong. I don't know that when you see people get a credit card that has a 25% interest on it, I'm hoping that people aren't dumb enough to say, boy, that's a real number, and I can do that. I think most people don't care what the rate is because they never expect to be in debt. I'm just going to pay it off for a moment. What's the difference if it's 10 or 100? Because if you shop around, and I'm not, doing people's credit card shopping for them, you can probably get one that's 10 if you want to go to a credit union or someplace. I mean, if you really worked at it, you can. But that's not, I think there's all these little landmines around everybody that they don't, nobody, I'll say very few families, and more mothers with kids, and every year, the medical stuff, not only is the price of insurance for like the PTI securities buying it for people, generally the deductibles for the people have crept up. I don't know how many of your friends, and even though you're with a group that, makes money, your professors, for God's sake, so they're not scrambling for minimum wage. I don't know how many people you know that if one of the kids, sprains an ankle or something, goes to the emergency room, and their deductible's $5,000, and the next day the transmission blows out on the car and it's $5,000. I don't know how many people can write that $10,000 check without batting an eyelash. I don't know many. So that's going to end up on the credit card. I mean, I still have, and maybe you can talk me out of this, I have enough faith in human nature, as much as it seems to be receding as I age, that I'm just not going to come home with the credit card and the wife or me is going to walk out and buy $10,000 worth of furniture that I know I got to start paying interest. I can't believe people do that, but maybe they do. I mean, most bankruptcy causes are because of a health event, right?
I don't know if I agree completely with you.
Okay, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah, and again, this is just as a mom, particularly like around Christmas, and I should also preface this. My children's birthday, my children's are in November and in January. And then my niece and nephew, who are essentially the same age as my children, are in December and January as well. So we've got four kids within this time period of birthdays, and we have Christmas for all these kids, right? So it's a lot of presents, a lot of toys. You don't, when you're shopping, you don't necessarily remember think about the budget. So you end up buying a bunch of stuff. And I think particularly around the holidays, people's memories for how much money that they actually have, they end up spending a lot more than they are anticipating in spending. And then there's the somber January when they get that bill. So yes, I agree with you 100% about if your kid goes to the emergency room, it's $1,000. Hopefully that comes off from the deductible. Maybe it doesn't, maybe it does. It's weird what gets applied to the deductible and what doesn't. But that $1,000 comes out of your pocket. I agree with you there, but I also think that people overspend not thinking about it. And, you know, part of it is we're in a culture where we're expected to spend. We're told that this is what Americans do and that cutting back is wrong. At Christmas time, as somebody with children, the amount of requests for teacher gifts, for student aid gifts, for staff gifts, and it becomes quite cumbersome once you start to pay out for all of these additional gifts on top of your kids' gifts, on top of everything else you're doing, the amount of Christmas activities, yep, like going to the zoo, and then you got to go out to dinner afterwards. That stuff adds up very quickly, and it's very difficult to be the parent that says to their kid, no, you can't do it. This is what all your friends are doing, but you're the one who's going to have to sit out.
Well, you're describing one hell of a January hangover for retailers and restaurants.
Yes.
Well, I mean, some of it, though, is if you know, put yourself in a position, you're in happy suburbia, right where Russell lives, and you and hubby are working, and you've got, you know, the kids in maybe private school, and you've got a couple of nice cars, and you got the house, and everything is, you know, you're not, like you said earlier, you're not saving a whole hell of a lot, but you're kind of on the edge, and one of you gets laid off, and you,
right,
say, and you say, okay, are we going to immediately yank the kids out of private school? Probably not. Are we going to sell the car and go buy a junker? Probably not. You're going to sit there and go, okay, we'll deficit finance for 3-4 months while somebody looks for a job. How bad can it get? And in some eras, you got a job 2 weeks from now and you don't even blink, right? Now, sometimes, maybe now it's a year and you go, wait a minute, we got all these credit card bills. Now what? I mean, and you still don't have another job, or maybe you do and it's not as much pain as the one before. I mean, this can creep up on you pretty easily in an economy that's sneakily worse than maybe you think.
There's a movie called The Company Men, and Ben Affleck is in it. And his character loses his job in the 2008 crash. In the film, his wife is a nurse, so she retains her job. But they eventually have to sell their home. And there's a great scene where she sells the Porsche. Ben Affleck's character is Porsche, and the look on his face of, we have to lose the Porsche, and she said, you haven't worked in 6 months.
Yeah,
we can't afford it.
I mean, it's, for some reason, we never really want to face stuff like this when it happens, but now we have, you know, a political group that absolutely wants to lie about it. I mean, are we ever, right, get another CPI number?
Well, you and I have a difference of opinion about whether or not the CPI is a lie.
You think it isn't?
No, but we've gone discussed how it really shouldn't be looked at as the end-all and be-all, and we should understand how it's constantly changing the calculation, the basket is changing, that the time period that we're looking at is also maybe not as indicative as what actual people are feeling. So for example, if you're looking at quarter to quarter data or year to year data, we might not see a lot of inflation. But if we look at the 5-year data, it's going to be very different. And again, if we're looking at this situation where we've got different classes of people, or economic classes, pardon me, and they're feeling the inflation differently. So again, I don't think inflation is necessarily being lied about. I don't think people are interpreting it or using it correctly.
Well, the two spots that I bring up, and again, I've always been trying to, we should be with Russell at a coffee shop, him and his cardigan, talking about this. But once in a while, I get one I think right. Once in a great while, there was a report on News Radio 78 last week where they were talking about inflation. And I think you've been on a couple times when I've said, look, if I don't think that the price of rice on there is being lied about. If somebody's going out and getting it, and maybe there's an adjustment that maybe you and I wouldn't agree with. But the two biggest holes that I see are, and they're glaring, they're right in your face, are the hospital being 6.5% of your basket when it's 21% of the economy. So that's a flat-out lie. The other one is, and I don't know when they did this, this owner's equivalent rent thing, which doesn't come close to the cost of home ownership. And these are the two obvious ones that I've been ragging about really for 20 years. So this report comes out the other day, and they did this big survey about inflation and homeowners and blah, blah, blah. Guess what they said? The two biggest issues are medical expenses and home ownership. So it's not like I'm the only one that's figured this out. I mean, those two things, if you took the inflation or the medical stuff, and I, you know, if Russell had his computer, if you took that from 6% of your basket to even 15 or 16 and went back 20 years, I think you have the economy in a recession for almost all of those years. That's not even going after the house one. I mean, if you were to add 1.5-2% a year, how close are we to have been in a recession? Well, since 2000, for God's sake, we're right there, aren't we?
Sure.
I mean, we had the fiasco here in Chicago with all these tax increases going up. I mean, Nancy was on last week talking about the tax increases in some of these areas are screwing up people's ability to get a mortgage. I went to get a load of that. Christmas Day, we go to the dog park. Audrey's pooch, the poodle, she loves it. She runs back and forth. She'll run 50-yard dashes for hours if you let her. So there's this old guy sitting there, and imagine me bullshitting with the guy, right? And he's got his old scruffy dog sitting there. And he says his daughter got a job in the city, buys herself a house. I think he said house, might have been a con. I think it was a small house on the north side. And he says she just gets her tax bill, and it went from like 12 grand to like 18 or 17 or something. And he goes, she just doesn't have it. There's no way she's got another, she's right at the edge. There's no way she's got another $400 or $500 a month to send a check into the county. Now, okay. So where in the CPI is your property tax? Nowhere, is it? Is it even in there?
I don't believe that it is. I also think it's property tax is a very difficult thing to incorporate because property taxes vary so dramatically across the country. So my parents had a house in Michigan, and it was rural Michigan, and I think they paid $1,000 a year in property taxes.
Yeah, well, I mean, but I'm saying it. None of these things are kind of incorporated, and they're starting to hit people pretty hard. I mean, when you don't have money, everybody's out got their hand out.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing. Yeah. I'm fully agreeing with you. I think though, calculating these things and putting them into a CPI would be very difficult, because again, we have such a wide disparity of property taxes. And I would assume, and I could be very wrong in this, that my parents' house in Michigan, because it was much larger than this house on the North Shore or the North Side. So again, it's location. And once you start to aggregate those numbers up, it paints a very different picture. And that's why CPI isn't necessarily a lie, but it's not telling the story that you think it should be telling. And it might not be telling the story that you're actually feeling, right? And we could make the argument about healthcare that, you know, if you're a young person in their 20s, you might not have any healthcare expenses, right?
Boy, don't break a finger playing softball. Go to an emergency room.
Well, but if you're not playing softball, let's say, I mean, and I don't believe in my 20s I spent much time in the emergency room.
No, I mean, most of us didn't, but we were lucky, I guess.
But the point is then we don't have those expenses, right?
Well, no, I'm just saying when things, I did a, this is, well, we're 2026 almost, about right before COVID, I did a little, you know, back of my ass kind of a study, and I took three things. At the time, from 2000 to 2020 or 21, wherever I was, I looked at the CPI, and it was something like, it was up 80% of your stuff. So I took healthcare, and again, this is sloppy, because, you know, how can you be, you don't know. I just looked at the amount of money, the average amount of money that a firm like PTI or Purdue pays in healthcare for an average employee for that 22 years. And it was up 285%, so roughly triple the CPI. And now that's a big number. And I went to the cost of higher education, and this will floor you, the exact same number, 285. And now this is even sloppier. You give me an F paper, but I tried to figure out the cost of primary education. So sloppily, I looked at Illinois and the increases in property taxes over the 22 years, and roughly, I think your primary education is about 50% of most people's property taxes, isn't it? Some places it's 48, some it's 52. But again, this is sloppy. Again, Larissa, the same number, 285. So these are three areas that are massive, and I'm cheating because I bet every single, even PTI, where we tried not to do this, over a period of time, even though our prices went up, people's deductible went up, those kinds of things. So it really was cheating to the other side on the hospitalization piece. So how can three things that big in people's life be three times the CPI and it not be a, quote, lie? Lie maybe is the wrong term. I'll go with you on that. But what is it? I mean, when you do it year after year after year.
Again, I think this is one of those things that it's really difficult to measure. And it's intentionally excluded because of that.
All right. So an intentional. You know what? As a professor and a mother, I'll ask you a question. Because you know, you're in charge of molding people.
Yes.
Which is worse, a flat-ass lie or a lie of omission?
Oh, I'm going to go with the flat lie.
Really?
Yeah, as I have been lied about to both of those things, and we have had many discussions in our household recently about lying. Yep, I'm going to go with the bold lie to my face.
I almost think the other one is when you give like the wrong answer or half an answer and make it sound like it's okay. The best, you're not, I don't know if I'm much of a sports person. You are. Do you remember when during the steroid era, the Congress dragged all these guys, baseball guys that were supposedly on steroids up in front of Congress? Because there's all the, you know, a lot of, I'm going to say the moms, were all basically complaining that, I don't want my kid having to be on steroids in high school just to play baseball. You know, these guys can't be the role model. So they get Sammy Sosa up there. I'm sure you remember that name.
Oh, I remember Sammy.
And Sammy gets up there and he starts talking about, and whoever wrote this had to be the dean of the Purdue Law School. he goes, I said, what about steroids? And he says, I have never injected myself with steroids, which means he's afraid of shots, which would be too, a steroid shot. And he goes, and I've never broken the laws of the Dominican Republic or the United States. And to this day, everybody will say, he said he never took steroids. No, he didn't. No, he didn't.
No, he didn't.
he said he could go to Mexico and drop five pills, and he's okay. He never once said he didn't take steroids, did he?
Well, or plus I didn't inject myself. Well, did somebody else inject you?
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure I'd want that either, but those guys were... anyway, I mean, it is amazing what people can conjure up as the truth, isn't it?
It is.
I got to believe that you mother types are really good at seeing through that. Isn't it part of the instinct?
Well, I appreciate that. My eldest, he's like, how can you tell I'm lying? And I'm like, you're not that good yet.
When I was a janitor for the public schools, and I was at South Shore High School, right? And this, the guy who was the chief janitor, a guy named Ellie Walker, I think was his name. Big black guy. What a nice guy. And he had played football somewhere, but he's in there. He's looking kind of down in the dumps one day, and I go, Ellie, what's up? And he goes, that's my son. He goes, he thinks he's being like really slick. I go, what does that mean? He goes, first of all, he goes, I'm pissed at him for trying to get one around me. He goes, I thought we had a better relationship that. He goes, but I'm really pissed off because he's so bad at it.
Yeah, I know.
he goes, I was way better. He goes, I'd actually get away with one once in a while. He doesn't have a chance. he was all disappointed that the kid was really bad at it, in addition to the fact that he tried. Anyway, this year, we got to take off here. The last 6 months of this year, with all the stuff we did on the veterans and you being one of our newer guests, I've enjoyed the last 6 months more than I ever have doing the show. I mean, I thought we've really dug into some stuff, and you are a big part of that. And
thank you.
Russell as well, but he's been here a while. But you are a big part of that, and I think everybody enjoys you being here, and we're going to continue to have newer people, and maybe you can bring a student on like he's done it a couple times to find out what the rest of the world is doing. I wish you the happiest new year you've ever had. And
you as well. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Are you going to make it to 12 o'clock tonight?
Oh, no.
At least 11 o'clock and see the new year in New York?
No. No, I am usually in bed by 9 o'clock.
Oh, God. Well, I hope I can. I don't know what I'm doing with the what time his wedding's going to be. All right. I'm anxious to see all these people, but it wouldn't be my day when I'm working all day and nobody else is. But I guess that's
I don't know. I mean, you've got a new shirt and pants. I'm sure you're going to look quite dapper.
I'm sure the girlfriend will find something wrong with it, you know.
Okay.
I mean, I have this. I haven't worn a suit in 4 years. Nobody. I never thought I'd have to wear one again, except when they laid me out. Right. It should be fun. And I look to talk to you next week. And enjoy yourself. And you know, you might want to see the ball's going to come down again. In July, right? Because they're going to do it for the day, the moment that they sign the Declaration of Independence. Have you heard that story?
That's exciting.
That's quite a day. We'll have to celebrate that too on the show. Anyway, SP Futures now we're up 6. Maybe Kenny's right. We're gonna make a run to the upside here. NASDAQ Futures up 33. Larissa, thank you. Happy New Year, Andrew. Happy New Year, everybody. Back on Friday, Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.